Thank you for all coming. Another exciting afternoon. I plan to leave here at 5:15. If you guys still want to talk, you're welcome to stay and talk to each other all you want. Do we have an agenda? We were going to go over some of the questions that were asked last time, some of the answers.
That's right. So we'll start there and then
leave lots of time for Mr. Ben to talk about Metro Rail.
There we go.
And it's going to allow the committee time to really hear what Ben has to say on that. We're thinking, try to look through the questions and answers in about 30 minutes.
You know the origin of that?
No.
In the Middle Ages, the sneeze was the first sign that you had the bubonic plague. And people would say, God bless you, for you are doomed. We have dropped the last part of that.
That's good.
Okay, so to get started on the first part, questions and answers, Mrs. Caniff will address these. The handout you've got is structured roughly by the slides that you saw previously. So what we tried to do is pull out the specific questions. Not every question's answered because, you know, for instance, at the end there was a discussion of, well, what happened with the pupil generation rates if Dr. Adamo's model's coming out kind of in the ballpark for kids, but our population is not in the same place, how do we deal with that? That, I'm thinking, is more appropriate to delve into more deeply instead of just providing some data answers, and we can look at those sorts of questions at the meetings we'll have in 2012. So if you did have a question that you don't see on here, this is meant to be pretty complete. So I guess, Leslie, the committee could email you and we'll follow along on that, or you can just let me know at this meeting and I'll have that in my notes for next year.
Okay.
And with that, I'll turn it to Mrs. Haney.
Okay, so you've got your handout here today. And the questions on the first two pages are listed. And it's just a summary, and you'll see under each one, some of them say handout. So the handouts are attached in the order of that we have things listed on the summary pages. So we're going to begin by, first thing on the list is the HUD income. We had questions last time about what is the most recent HUD AMI, as well as how is it defined and how does it compare to our allowed and median income from the Census Bureau? So we'll clarify that for you. That is the first handout. So let's see, the HUD median income for 2010 was $103,500 as compared to the American Community Survey, which was $119,000. Reason for the difference is partly the way HUD defines things. HUD defines it regionally rather than specific to the county. So the Loudoun County number for HUD is the same as, say, Prince George's, Montgomery County. It's the same for the whole region. It's a regional number. Therefore, it's lower since we are at the top in the region. And the other thing is HUD's number is based on a family of four, which we mentioned last time. And part of the way that HUD estimates their number is by using the American Community Survey data. So when they did the 2011 data, which is now out, they used the 2005 to 2009 American Community Survey five-year data. So they take that and then they will forecast the 2011 data using statistical methods, because the 2010-2011 data is not available at the time they're doing those estimates. Whereas, which makes it another difference, is the fact that it's an estimate, whereas since it's a forecast, whereas the Census Bureau's number is an actual estimate. So
based on a survey
for that year. So that's the HUD income. And then we had questions about household income distribution from Mr. Capretti. He wanted to to have more details on the number of households in each income cohort. So we have put that together, and you will see that right after the HUD income data piece, you'll see a table that gives you the actual number of households in each cohort. And then after that is the graph that displays the actual number of households by income. And in this, you'll see a similar trend to what we saw for the share of households graph that we presented last time. So you'll see again the income in the lower cohorts is going down, the number of households, that is going down in the low income and going up in the high income. So same trends.
So it's not just that new households,
right?
It's also that older household, that, you know, existing households no longer have that, you know, that lower income. That's interesting.
Yeah, and there was a question of, like, to what extent does inflation come into play, Mr. Brown?
Thank you. Can I use the blackboard just real quick? Because I don't have a handout, and I wanted to illustrate one thing. The short answer is there's two things that you would do to answer that question. Look at the inflation over time, and those numbers are significant. In 2005 or 2006, the 5-6 difference, it was 4%. The next year, 3.6. The next year, 3.6. The next year, 4.5. It was only 0.2% in the 2009 period. And then going into 10, it went back up to 1.7. But the upshot is, from 2004 to 2010, the CPI inflation changed 19%. If you apply that to those income cutoffs, your 200,000 top limit would have gone, had it been fully adjusted for inflation, to 238,000. Okay? But another twist is that when you look at Jill's table on that you have in your handout that gives you the number of people in each category, the question is, as our population grew, our household grew over time, you would expect each of those categories to grow by two factors. One, an inflation push, as the categories limits get, just like you get pushed into a new federal income tax bracket, people get pushed into the next bracket up or down. But the average household growth for that period was, for the first year, 2005, 7.4, 6.2, 4.3, 2.9, 2.0, and 2.2. So you have a substantial household growth on top of the inflation. And so what I did is said, let's add inflation plus household growth and see whether or not the growth in those income categories, in other words, the percentage of people that fell into the next category, corresponded. And in all but two cases, the sum of inflation plus household growth was lower than we actually saw. And that would lead you to conclude that indeed you got more rich people, or you got people in those higher income categories after some adjustment for inflation. So that's the short answer. However, I think that overstates it a little bit, and that's why I wanted to draw one. You're satisfied at that point?
I'm satisfied, okay. And I want to keep an eye on that clock, because we were only going to spend about 30 minutes answering with these answers. Most of the answers are included in the packet. So,
okay. Well, that's your quick and dirty answer.
There is some growth in rich people coming in.
Yes.
More?
Yes.
Or their incomes growing faster once they're here.
Yes.
We can't separate those two things.
But almost certainly both are growing.
Okay, so the next bullet point on the summary page on the front is the share of two earner households. Ben had mentioned that the share of two earner households helps explain the high household income. So we have presented data right below that. In this table, it shows the percent of married couple households with both husband and wife in the labor force. So you can see Loudoun is the highest of the region, and higher than Fairfax, and much higher than the USA. So that leads partly to us having the high median income. And next is the population. Mr. Mitchell had asked, didn't most of the population slowdown and stuff happen in years like 2007 on? So we have a table in your handout of the 2000 to 2010 years. So you can see what percentage of the growth occurred in those years. And that is this table here. So you are correct that pretty much 2007 on, you got great slowing in our growth rates. So you can reference this for that information. What this table also shows you is our new forecast for 2000.
These are calendar years?
These are calendar year, and the effective date is April 1st, same day as the census is what we use. These are our new 2040 forecasts that we're using for the budget process, as well as for the next COG round that we're working on right now. And this is produced using the permit numbers and all that we showed you last week. Next, how close did the COG jurisdictions come in their round 80 forecast compared to the 2010 census? So I've provided you with that information for your reference, and that's this table here. And you'll see Loudoun, like I said last time, had one of the greatest percentage errors in their in the estimates. But again, we had some of the greatest growth.
Correct.
But Prince William did very well, you know, and they had large growth too. So you can reference that.
So that's 7.14, right?
Yes,
yeah,
so
7.14,
yeah, the population came in 7% above round 80, which is the forecast we previously had. But I think in absolute terms, Loudoun did grow more than any other jurisdiction, more people. 2000.
So next is race and ethnicity. Mr. Burton had asked what component of Asians are South Asian Indians, and how are Asians classified? Like, is it South Indians and South Asians? And I have printed out the American Fact Finder sheets from our demographic profile from the 2010 census, and that you can find on the Research Unit website, that file, for more information. And on the second page, you'll see this page here, and I've got the red outline, and it's pointing to the Asians, so you can see how the Census Bureau classifies Asians. And you've got the Indians, Chinese, Filipinos, and all of those there, with Indians being 43% of all Asians in Loudoun.
Okay.
And next, Mr. Winters had asked what the education levels are by race. So that is your next page in your handout. You've got bachelor's degree or higher, your Asians have the largest percentage of their population with that degree.
Wow.
Yeah, more so than the white non-Hispanic population.
I can remember seeing data in the USA Today a few years back that showed that Asians have a higher average income than whites.
And that is actually our next.
You just led right into that one. You
went right into it.
Right, the segue role, Mr. Mitchell, last time.
That's usually your role.
That's great. And for the Asians, Loudoun.
Yep.
Is that this is showing you the 2009 inflation adjusted. In this table, we're actually using the 2005 to 2009 five-year estimate American Community Survey because of it's much more reliable for small population sizes like your racial groups, much more reliable than the one-year American Community Survey that is.
So that's when you see that total and it's 112, that's not going to match up with any other income numbers you see for us, but this is the best way to break it down by these groups.
Yeah, for accuracy and reliability. The Asians do not have as high an income as the whites in this case.
In our county, but in the United States they do.
But in the U.S.,
right,
yeah.
The U.S. are in the lead. Mm-hmm.
I just find that hard to believe.
Yeah, I do too.
But you mean in our county?
In our county.
Yeah.
Well,
we have an awful lot of Indians in Eastern Loudoun that work at the high-tech companies. Very good salaries.
Right, but we also have a fairly highly educated white population.
Well, that's true.
Is it two household income?
This is everybody.
This is the whatever the
right,
household
so
income.
Right, so a lot of Indian women don't work.
That's true.
It's the husband that's making the money.
You're absolutely correct. Yeah. You're making a lot of money.
Correct.
Okay.
So that would explain that to me.
Yeah. That's
I think one of the other things is to think about how, in real terms, how little differentiation there is between these two.
Okay.
Well, between the Asians and the whites, but look at the difference between the other races. Look at the Hispanics.
But it's not necessarily as great a gradation. No, just about the same, I guess, as it is for the D.C. metro area.
Okay. Education.
These numbers are so high. How high these numbers are.
On the next page, you'll see the breakdown of the citizenship status. Mr. Mitchell had asked what the breakdown was, and Loudoun's citizenship status is 10.5% non-U.S. citizen. We don't know how many are illegal or
documented or undocumented.
Right. Right. They do not report that from the Census Bureau. They don't ask it either.
I'm just thinking that those kind of income levels, you probably not having a lot of undocumented.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
Well, the ones a job market out there.
But the ones that are undocumented don't report their income.
Right. Well, there's that.
Okay.
And then if you go back to your second page with the summary list, we've got a table listed there under the age population section. Mr. Capretti had asked what the median age trends are. Actually, you asked pretty much what the distribution was back in 1990 and 1980,
right.
So you had more history. Mm-hmm. And here we're just providing you median age because it's easier to compare and see the trends and stuff. So you'll see Loudoun compared to the USA, we've got a greater gap over time in our age group. So we're definitely staying much younger than the rest of the country.
We are slightly getting older.
We are getting older.
The rest is getting older faster.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yep, because as I explained last week, we have a very young population that keeps coming into the county, which keeps our median age low, at least not rising as fast as the U.S.
Keeps the number of live births every year way up.
Okay, and then household size and vacancy rates by planning sub-area was asked for a comparison of 2000 to 2010. Mr. Capretti had asked that. So you'll see that on the last handout, last page of your handout. Actually, that is the last. So this shows you the vacancy rates in 2000 and 2010 and how they changed in the past 10 years, as well as the household sizes by the planning sub-areas and how those changed.
These are your estimates? Or what's the source?
These are the Census Bureau.
Okay.
So these are actuals.
Most of them have gone up.
You know, and the argument's always been that, you know, you'll have, as housing stock gets older, there's going to be fewer people living in those homes. And we're
seen that, huh?
We're loud. It doesn't matter how old the house is, we have kids in it.
My house is 202 years old, and I still have 28 years to go on the original warranty.
I don't know what builder that was.
So based, so just going to ask a question. So Dulles, our fastest growing planning sub area.
It has been.
Has a household size that went from 2.7 to 3.16.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Lots of kids.
Must be something in the water.
There are kids all over the place in the central part of the town. From, I don't know about north of the Greenway, but from the Greenway south, I mean, everywhere you look. Everywhere. You step on, they're hard to walk around.
Is that what you've been saying, Sam? This is where you say, this is what I've been saying. We've been missing you at these meetings.
He's a believer now. Boots on the ground.
That's right.
Okay. Lastly, on the second page of your handout, the summary list, we got the new units analysis section is where we're at now. The question was asked, what is the overall average household size and vacancy rate for the new units? Is what we should, last week was just the breakdown of the unit type. Mm-hmm. And everyone was curious the household size of the new units, which is 3.13. Whereas the overall county's household size is 2.98. So the new units are higher than the overall county. And the vacancy rate for the new units is 4.0%. Do you recall?
Is that high or low? That's really not a big number.
That's a pretty low number, I think. It's a lower number than we anticipated.
Compared to commercial
buildings. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me, though, because, I mean, builders aren't building spec houses anymore. Right.
But, you know, given the, you know, the, even giving the foreclosure stuff, we're just not leaving buildings vacant.
Yeah, I'm guessing that 4% is probably a lot more multifamily, too, mm-hmm. would be my guess.
For the vacancy rate, that's correct. From the data we showed last week, multifamily was right. Much higher than the other unit types.
No, that makes sense.
Okay.
So that's all I have to say. Staff. Did you have anything else?
Just one other thing that was handed out. So you know, hopefully this information will be good for you to be thinking about and digesting before we meet again. This particular report was put together by the Council of Governments for the region, so it gives you some more food for thought if you want to start comparing Loud, and it does show the absolute growth that provides information on racial group by jurisdiction. It has some maps that show you patterns of distribution, so gives you a chance to look at the regional perspective as well.
Wow, Fairfax grew almost as much as Prince William? That's amazing.
Well, it's hard to tell.
If you look on the second page, share of growth. Mm-hmm. I mean, Loudoun's first, Prince William second, and Fairfax is a very close third. I just don't think Fairfax is growing that fast.
Well, they built a lot of apartments and condos. And they did continue to build out the western tier.
Oh, and this is a 10-year, right?
Right.
This is over 10, okay.
Right. Fairfax hasn't grown very much.
They've only built one school, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's because they built a lot of condos, and they built a lot. And then the other place they built is that whole Woodyard area, you know, west of 123
right.
in the southern part.
Right.
Southern Fairfax has grown a lot.
We used Wharton, to live there. Yeah.
I used to live there. Yeah. Right. Wharton. They're building that
where the jail was.
Quite a bit. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Landfill acres.
It's very, very impressive.
Very yeah, nice work.
Thank you. Mark. All right. Talking about the study we had done earlier this year by Barbara Charles Lesser. In general, we wanted to know, given that phase one is underway, phase one of the metro construction is underway, which means that the rail line's being built from the Falls Church stations to Wheelie Avenue. What difference did it make to the county whether rail came out to the two county stations? And so they took a look at all of the documents we had. They looked at COG 8.0. They looked at Moody's.com's forecast for the county. And then they did their own analysis. And that's what was in the book that I, you know, gave you last week. In general, as far as it applies to this committee, they, on the residential side, their numbers were pretty much our numbers because that, you know, the...
That's where you got it.
The, you know, and, well, and the... And the supply of housing in Eastern Loudoun is the supply of housing in Eastern Loudoun. And over the period between now and 2040, we're going to largely build out the single-family detached, attached, and most of the multifamily over this time period. So their, the, you know, their difference between, on the residential side, between stopping at Wheelie and coming on into the county was only 4,800 housing units. And those 4,800 housing units are the ones that you're able to build at Moorfield and Loudoun Station as a result of rail.
Right.
You know, so, you know, then, you know, that's, and that's, you know, you can only build them if you have rail. So there was no real net difference other than what we were already.
Well, I don't quite understand. Why is that? Because the demand wouldn't be there, or why?
Yes.
Why?
Yeah. But that, you know, in the very back of all of this is a set of numbers that that we don't advertise anywhere. But I was looking at them again today. They as part of their analysis, they grew the region out over the next 30 years, and then they allocated out, especially in Northern Virginia, those units. The demand for units and the units themselves and the employment to Loudoun, Fairfax, etc. And one of the things that they did is say, well, what, you know, what would be the, knowing what we know about or projecting what they were projecting about commercial growth, what would be the demand for housing as a result of that? So they have a table, which is table 1-30 and 1-31 back in the bowels of this document. Little tiny print, which all of us struggle with at this point. And in there they have the they have an estimate of Loudoun County's structural demand. And it's down near the bottom of the down near the bottom of page, you know, of exhibit 1-30. On the far right, in the third from the bottom cluster of numbers, is a number in bold, 80,323. And that would be their estimate of the unfettered demand for housing units in Loudoun County if there were sufficient supply. There is only sufficient supply for roughly 60,000 units. So there's about 20,000 units.
Because of zoning and everything.
Because of planning
current,
and zoning.
Current. Yeah.
Current planning and zoning, yes.
And tie that back to the 4,700 that you started off by saying that.
Okay, this is phase one extension. This is just the, if it stopped at Wheelie Boulevard.
Okay.
So if you stop at Wheelie Boulevard, the demand for, you know, when you look at the commercial growth and you look at the residential growth that would come from the commercial growth, you would they project that we would need have a demand for 80,000 housing units out here.
Okay. Over what period of time?
By 2040.
Okay.
And that we will supply 60,000.
Because the prices will go up.
That would push some prices up. Yes. So, and you know, when you look to the next page. The demand, you know, if you go all the way out, you know, if the rail line comes out, if phase two part of the rail line happens, then you get a regional, you get a Loudoun demand of 85,900.
While, can anyone read these pages?
It's very hard. While you have,
I don't know how Ben is managing, but he's done it.
Yeah.
A few of us have this in PDF, and we can see it a little bigger.
And the And actually, if you look online, that's you'll be able to, you know, actually look at some of this stuff. And then the, you know, and again at that level, we have because of the additional units allowed at Moorfield and
because it would be rezoned.
At 772. Oh, okay. It's already zoned. It's just the zoning is triggered.
You need
triggered it. Okay, gotcha.
So there you have almost 86,000 units demanded. There'll be about 65,000 units available.
I see. I got it.
As a result, there.
The zoning on Moorfield Station was approved almost 10 years ago, but it was set in phases. If you have only automobile transportation, you can build so many mm-hmm. houses. If you have just bus rapid transit, you can build so many. And metro, you can go to the full nine
right.
yards.
Right. So but won't we just, as this demand for 85,000, you know, comes about, won't we just rezone and build 85,000?
Perhaps, or perhaps that demand will be, you know, will be pushed to other areas. And that's part of what they do, is that they do move some of the demand around to, you know, other jurisdictions. But that, you know, but they took that into consideration in this, you know, is that this will be the...
I have a question.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk about this demand stuff. Mm-hmm. What causes the demand?
People want to live somewhere near where they work. Rational people want to live somewhere near where they work.
So, this study implies that we'll get a lot more work established here.
One of the tables shows huge number of jobs doubling, more than doubling.
Well, they have the number of businesses have doubled in this county in the last 10 years.
Yes. They've got strong numbers for commercial, flex, retail, and hotel growth.
Do those things drive the housing, or does the housing drive those things? Do those things follow the rooftops, or do the rooftops?
Well, some got to be some of both.
They're right. Driving the way they have done this. It's the potential jobs that are driving the housing.
Okay.
You know, Michael's not going to build any houses unless there's a demand for houses. The only way there's a demand for houses is if people are moving here for jobs. I mean, people don't just move here because it's nice.
Well, what kind of jobs? Well, you don't just create jobs out of thin air, do you?
Well, I mean, there's been a number of companies who, for various reasons, have wanted to relocate headquarters and other activities to the yep. Washington metropolitan area,
yeah.
and Loudoun County is, probably the best choice, or one of the best choices.
They want to get as close as they can to the U.S. Treasury.
But back here in these pages, then, they distribute that housing demand by the different categories across the different planning sub-areas. And...
But these aren't our planning sub-areas, are they?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 606 station area.
Well, okay. There's two different things going on here. We have them distributed by the planning sub-areas, and then we specifically ask them for each of the stations to tell us what's going on.
Oh, I see. Okay, now I got you.
Because that part of it is that we knew that around each of the stations there would be a much higher real estate value. You know, so we wanted to treat them separately so that we could get, remember, the point of this was a fiscal analysis of what's the impact of this. So it's not just the idea of new stuff, but it's new, more valuable stuff that we were really caring about.
But I thought they made the point in here that a lot of this is not net new. It is substitute for some new that would have occurred somewhere else in the county.
Yes. If you go to, I'll get there in just a minute. Mm-hmm. If you go to Exhibit I-39, on the top of the page says what we said before, which is that over time the model is all pretty much run together. Their analysis is very similar to what ours was, except for Moody's.com, which is insane.
They've missed a few other things too.
They have over their time. Yes. Okay. Then on the bottom of the page you see what happens here: the single family detached. You see that. Being exhausted, you see the multifamily changes, and then you see the single family attached, over this time period.
If there was a line on 1.38 that was without metro, what would that line look like? In other words, instead of doing the baseline to Wheelie, what if the baseline was nothing?
We originally, when we first sat down with them, that's what we asked, was them to do that, and then after we thought about it for a while, we said, we don't know how to do that.
Why does it mean anything?
Well, also, we didn't know how to do it. Because what's already baked into the market in terms of values and all the rest of this stuff going on is the idea that this project had already started. So once something starts, it's really hard to back out. the impact of that, at least in terms of, and since we're primarily concerned about taxation and values.
You're talking about phase one.
Right.
Right.
But really, if you go to some of the earlier, all the growth in the outer years when Metro gets here is multifamily.
Yes.
There's no single family.
That's
at all.
Yeah. Well,
multifamily
that's
would be actually attracted to a metro stop.
Right.
That land around the metro stop is too valuable to put a single family detached house on it. Right.
Hopefully so.
Oh, good. So this isn't the whole county? This is just the land around the metro?
No, this is a countywide.
This is the whole county.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're not, you know, they're not growing, they're not seeing a big impact. As part of this analysis, there's a little bit of impact in the western sub-areas, but there's not much. I mean, they're really seeing the impact of this being, you know, in the eastern sub-areas. So,
I mean, like in this, even if you go to like the phase two, they're basically saying in Ashburn after 2015, there's no single family detached.
Right.
Zero.
And that has to do with the supply that's available to continue to build.
Not much up there.
Yeah, you know, you'd have to go in and rezone. I mean, you'd have to go in, you know, for there to be more in Ashburn, you'd have to go in and take stuff that's currently zoned commercial.
Yeah, but there's plenty. There's already plenty in Ashburn.
No, but
Ashburn is big.
Nobody's saying it's not. I'm just saying if you wanted to add more, that's the only way you could do it. Because we're just going to exhaust the current zoning. None of this implies that this is either good or bad. It just is what it
but
is.
But sooner or later, we reach build out.
We
reach level off.
Every jurisdiction gets to choose how much of the regional employment supply, you know, they're going to supply housing to. You know, Fairfax County has made those decisions. Arlington County has made those. Alexandria, you know, they have ideas as to how they're going to grow. And you know, it's never made any sense to me that Loudoun would have to be the answer for residential for everybody else in the region. But they do have. But Loudoun is going to be a player in how the regional demand is met.
Okay, but the idea that taking the metro from Wheely to Loudoun County only produces 10% more housing units is because of the way the current plan and zoning is, right?
That's correct.
It chokes itself off.
But he's actually only shown about a five. Absent that, absent the difference between the two in terms of the unrestricted number is only like 6,000. So, you know, he's predicting 5,000 to 6,000 additional would be demanded, of which about 5,000 could be supplied by the zoning that's triggered at the stations.
Right. Okay.
So no, it's not a huge impact. He's not seeing a huge impact on Loudoun County between stopping at Wheely and coming all the way out here in terms of residential. And I'm not sure that's not incorrect. You know.
It depends upon how you define the impact. If it comes, I think there's a big difference between that stop at Wheely ending there. Or coming into the county, because if it ends at Wheely, our transportation network is going to have to refocus on how to get to Wheely. An awful lot of people are going to have to get to Wheely instead of getting to a couple places in Loudoun.
And he's just saying the larger impact is on the commercial side, frankly. And the you know, you look at table 141. I'm just back looking at the pretty graphs that they're actually.
Yeah,
they tell the story better. Right. You know, 141. You see the remaining supply of land, you know, largely being exhausted over the course, you know, from a residential perspective. Yeah. Over the time.
But this is just residential?
Yeah. And then, you know, all of the stuff in, all of the exhibit ones are residential. And then we have, you know, and then you know, the next table shows, for example, at the Route 28 station and the Route 772 station, what the residential demand is as a result of it. This time around, we had them take a look at Route 28 station. Even though it's in Fairfax, we've got properties in Loudoun that are close enough to it that we thought that they would be impacted. So actually, over the 2010 to 2040 time period, the 772 station is the major, you know, it gets the major impact both residentially and commercially. The Route 28 station is actually the next biggest impact to Loudoun County. The 606 station is the last one to develop. And it is not close to fully developed in terms of commercial at the end of that time period.
And it's almost all commercial.
It has to be, yeah, because it's in the airport.
That's not even on here.
Right, there's no residential development possible.
It's in the noise corridor.
Right.
It's all the commercial.
Yes, it's all in the noise corridor. Okay. And then, so that just shows, that just showed you what we put together for that. Then we had a look at, the employment side, which is, based on the commercial. And they again looked at, Moody's versus us, and they didn't go with Moody's. They actually get to one of the issues that we've had a lot of discussions about was whether our estimates unemployment forecast made sense or not. And there was a lot of discussions with COG that our household to jobs ratio was too aggressive. If you go to Exhibit 2-12, and you'll see their estimates for employment growth, our estimates, and Moody's, and you'll see that they actually fall somewhere in the long run in between the two. And then on the very next page, they predict the household jobs ratio. And the very last number, the 2040 number, in COG 8.0, we got up to a jobs to household ratio of 1.8. And remember, I think you all got a little pushback at the COG on those numbers. Right. RCLCO is saying that we were too conservative, that those numbers, would be 1.9, 1 to 1.97 if it was just phase one, and 1.88 if it was, the phase two.
So the higher the number, the more jobs there are here to go along with our households.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
So, the reason that it's less is that you've created a few more housing units.
Oh, right.
So, but it's interesting that they confirmed what they validated basically in their analysis the decisions that this committee had made that the regional planners didn't necessarily agree with.
How accurate have they been in the past doing this kind of work?
RCLCO?
Yeah.
I think we're still...
Has anyone bothered to check what they have predicted and what actually occurred?
We work very, very closely with them on all of this. So, it's their analysis also with an awful lot of feedback from Suzanne and I, and I don't know if Beth ever had a chance to spend much time on this, but a lot from Suzanne and I on, what numbers made sense on this. I think when we look back, they're the ones who did the original analysis for us on Moorfield Station. And I don't think they were, I don't think if we look back on those numbers that there's significant problems with that. Although rail hasn't happened yet, so kind of hard for us to say. I think, as with any firm that does fiscal impact analysis like this for you, they are limited in their outcomes by however much garbage whoever is paying the bills has insisted they put into the model. And, on those cases where, with some of the private sector clients, where the private sector client has given them what I think were specious assumptions, they produce specious results. But I tend to believe, and that's the reason we're happy to use them, is that when you give them results that you think make sense, the analysis comes back at the end of the day, and it seems to flow logically through their system.
Well, the surprise here is that Moorfield, if rail comes there, it doesn't generate as many extra demand from as many extra houses as I thought it would, or units or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, that's just not what they're showing. We went back and asked them a couple of times about displacement into Western Loudoun. Displacement of housing demand into Western Loudoun, and they just didn't find it to be a particularly significant event.
So we aren't going to have demand for housing.
I tend to disagree with that
for
particular people assumption.
To
I think
live
be
there
some
and
more.
Drive to Moorfield Station.
Yeah, I think there'll be some more.
I don't know,
but the significance is the impact on commercial and retail.
Yes,
it's huge. I mean, these numbers are crazy.
But it's not total net.
No, they're large though. The going back to the main body of the report, they they forecast on page 33 of the written part of the report at the beginning. They show office development forecast. There we did the office demand. We didn't do it by planning subarea. We did by quarter because we really think that's the way it's going to. That's the easier way for them to do analysis on commercial. So you look there on page 33, and you see, stopping at Wheelie, you get 18.3 million square foot of commercial. Coming all the way out here, you get 19.3 million, which is only 1 million square foot difference. But you get a relocation of 2.7 million that would happen somewhere else in the county to around the stations. And if that happens around those stations, that will be a much higher value development because the land around those stations will be much more valuable than whatever land they were going to build on before. Because we expect that'll be some of the most valuable land in the county.
And that's just office, though.
Yes, that's just office.
It's not retail.
There's some stuff on retail farther along.
And it said it wouldn't impact the flex industrial.
And they forecast no change. They forecast no change in flex industrial here, which again, both Robin and I think it probably, we're not sure we agree with that there'll be no flex impact. But
Dulles Airport really is what impacts that,
right.
I guess.
Yes.
A major extent.
Yeah, well, and the airport is telling us that the provision of rail to the airport itself makes no difference to them on their projections of ridership, of use of the airport.
Really?
Yep.
You mean without expanding runways?
Just in general.
Like it is today.
Why do they want to put it in?
Well, it's not the airport that wanted to put it in. It wasn't the airport's desire to do this.
I can believe that because the demand for air travel is the demand for air travel. How you get there, whether it's rail, unless an airline came in like Southwest and BWI and made a significant change on services and flights.
That could happen with or without rail.
That's correct.
But I
guess possibly you can also get to Dulles or National by rail too. So it's not like it's the only place you could go to an airport by rail.
But they have transfers right now that go to National and BWI. In fact,
I believe there will be some additional impacts at the airport as a result of this. Simply by making it sensibly easier for employees at the airport to get there. There may be opportunities for development at the airport that aren't there now, but it is a conservative estimate. On page 37 in the written part of the report, you've got the retail forecast. And again, you've got about 700,000 square foot of new retail as a result of this. Again, a lot of it around the stations themselves.
70772. Mm-hmm. Wow. A little slop over into Ashburn.
Two pages later, you have the hotel development. The hotel stuff, they didn't, their assumptions on this is that the main driver for the hotel stuff is going to continue to be the airport more than anything else. So there's not a lot of change countywide on the hotels, but they are looking at a relocation of future hotel growth from, that would right now, take place, say, in the Route 28 area, would instead take place closer to the stations. And again, higher value for us in that regard. Then, pages 41 and 42 have the full set of numbers as to, what the impacts of these are from their perspective. And again, the biggest, positive fiscal impact comes from the 772 station, because there's so much more development taking place there than the Route 28 station and then the Route 606 station. This isn't to say that the Route 606 station couldn't in 50 years, be some kind of, something else in terms of a driver. But at this point in time, they just weren't showing enough demand to make that really kick off. There are some tables. If you go through the tables in the back, they've done a lot of stuff using, showing which comparables they use to project office space and cost per square foot, and retail cost per square foot, et cetera. There's also some information there in the tables in the back that that show the hotel stuff. There's a bunch of benchmark data on hotels, and
maybe it's just me, but by the term fiscal impact, is that does that additional revenue?
Yes.
To the county?
Yes.
You can look tax revenue.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that taxable valuation or revenue?
Revenue.
Well, you can look at, there's more detailed information on the next page.
No, just the term fiscal impact. I thought that's what it meant, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
So it's the net of the revenues and expenditures.
It's a net of the revenues versus expenditure.
Correct.
So you got to figure out what to do with all this extra money.
Well, you know, what we're going to do with the extra money is pay for the rail project itself. That's the key, is to try to figure out.
I thought the commuters that use the Greenway were paying for the project.
Well, the commuters who use the Greenway pay nothing for this. The commuters who use the
Dulles Toll Road.
Dulles Toll Road will pay roughly 75% of the cost of this. Loudoun County itself will pay 4.8% of the combined Phase 1 and Phase 2 cost.
16% for Fairfax.
16% for Fairfax, 4.1% by the airport itself. Out of, you know, they are an original funding partner. So the three local partners do 25% between them. We get some additional money from the state. There was $900 million from the feds initially, or $700 million for the Phase 1, but the rest of it is really going to be supported with the tolls.
Then what's the total cost for financing that the county is going to have to do on this project?
What's in the budget is $315 million. That is almost certainly not going to be the number. Right now, if they succeed in taking out of the project all of the costs, I mean, the 315 was the highest number that we were at in terms of the construction cost for the project, and that was when we were, when MWA was still going to build the underground station at the airport, which would have been more expensive than all the other stations combined. And they, but now that that's off the table, and now that they're, you know, they're looking at doing some other stuff, all still subject to negotiation, we think probably our share will be in the 260 to 280 million area.
We're looking at about 30 million a year, plus or minus a few, for as far in the future as I can see.
For debt service and operating together.
For debt service and operating.
that's probably about right.
Does that start in 2017, FY?
No, it depends. Operating starts when it opens. You know, so right now, 2017.
And we have to pay the operating costs for the stations that are in our county.
Yes, including the airport station.
Including the what? The airport station?
Yes.
Okay. It's three stations.
Yes. And then...
Well, do you get some of the revenue from the ridership?
No.
No.
No, in fact, that's one of the things we have to figure out.
How did y'all negotiate that deal?
All of this goes to Metro. Metro operates this thing. We, you know, no, nobody, none of the funding partners want to be operating
You don't have to operate it. You just have to get some of the.
Well, one of the discussions going on right now is with regard to taking the parking garages that would be built as part of Phase 2 out of the project, and that we in Fairfax would find ways to operate them ourselves. Build them and operate them ourselves.
Find some guy who's willing to cough up the money and do it in exchange for high rent parking fees.
Right.
Right.
But they've done it at Wheelie Avenue. Fairfax has done it. And you know, we're looking at ways to do that. And they wouldn't have to be built to Metro standards. They could be built to
Is that with Comstock and Wheelie Avenue?
Yes.
But it doesn't exist. It's
perhaps not always the best example.
what about Vienna? What the parking in Vienna? Who controls that? Who handles that? Is that one of those?
It's Metro.
That's Metro.
But Fairfax has had a lot of involvement in building all of these things. What Fairfax has done is, Fairfax does collect a fee from all of the garages that they've helped Metro develop over time. And that's allowed Fairfax to put enough money away that they can kind of front money when a new garage has to be built, you know, in such a way that they can make these things not really hit the taxpayers. Okay. But they do it by everybody in the system, everybody in Fairfax who parks in a Metro garage is actually contributing to the, you know, to the new stations.
I had asked Mr. York to make the proposal in one of those gang of 10 meetings with Secretary of the Hood that we add a dollar or two to the Metro ticket itself rather than $5 or $6 to the toll road.
Mr. York has had that discussion.
And he tells me when he says it, he gets nothing but blank stares.
That is pretty much the reaction, yes. The you know, just so you know, we're in the midst of, you know, having some analysis done on parking demand, just to see whether that'd be a viable alternative or not for the county. And I'm sure once that study's done, I'll make sure the committee gets to see that stuff too, because there'll be a lot of interesting stuff that comes out of it. Whenever they do one of these kind of demand studies, there's other stuff that applicable to what we do here, I think, is part of it. Another study that we have that we'll have, you know, going soon, will be with regard to the Concora City Community Development Authority, proposed Concora Community Development Authority. We are looking, you know, at the board's request, we are analyzing that application. And one of the things we're doing is we've reached out and we're, a private firm is going to, assist us in sensitivity analysis regarding the business plan that drives the CDA as it's currently proposed.
Because
there are questions, if they're proposing that the amount of growth that's going to take place in the Concora development, both residential and commercial, over the next 10 years that would be used to pay off the CDA bonds or the state loan, and if it is a number that is significantly higher than, say, the forecast we have here for the entire Route 28 corridor, that would be cause for concern as to whether that's a viable structure on which to, allow someone to issue debt in Loudoun County.
There's an interesting, something interesting happened in Florida last week when a federal court ruled that when a CDA goes belly up and bankrupt and cannot meet its obligations, when a developer goes bankrupt who's dependent upon the CDA, that the CDA still exists. And it's not the CDA that goes bankrupt, it is the developer himself,
right,
which falls back on to the local jurisdictions then on how to deal with it. This bond buyer story.
It falls back to the underlying land. I mean, that's the problem. These things are tax districts, and they're tax districts, and it's a lien on the underlying land. The potential risk is that you're creating some kind of blighted area in one form or another that will be difficult for anyone to ever do anything with.
Yeah.
You mean if it fails?
Right.
Right. And there were 168 failures at CDAs in Florida last year.
Well, it's pretty clear that Florida kind of lost control of their whole development process.
In fact, the Attorney General in Florida is asking the legislature to pass a law in Florida to put upper limits on how much CDAs can borrow. And that's something worth thinking about.
I mean, if I remember right, Jack, the Flagler County numbers were that 25% of their household, of their housing stock was vacant.
As someone who sits on the Dulles Town Center Community Development Authority since its inception, there's a big difference between doing a CDA on a property like that that has a commercial base as opposed to doing CDAs for residential.
Yes.
I mean, big difference. Big difference.
Right, that's correct. I mean, because then the residences have to pay a special tax or added tax,
yeah,
and once they start foreclosing or losing their homes, no one's paying the taxes.
One of the things that we're looking at with Concora in particular is following along the New Kent County model with their CDA, where they require that residential units be bought out at occupancy,
mm-hmm,
be bought out of the district. Because in the long run, having talked to our peers around the state, everyone has a problem with, in the long run, with residential being charged a special assessment like that. There are just a variety of political and tax problems resulting.
But if we do that, that means an added fee on the sale price of a unit in the Route 28 tax district. That would be the second buyout fee added to the price of the unit. So what will that do to their competitiveness with other places?
That's part of the analysis that we're having done as
there's
we
a Route 28 tax district buyout for residential, and if you had a CDA buyout, those are two things added to the sale price.
And with Kinkora, there's also a, the developer, according to the loan that they wish to do to build Gloucester Parkway, the loan they're trying to do with the state for Gloucester Parkway, they're gonna increase their proffer to $35,000 per unit to repay that loan.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
So those are the kind of issues that we,
It doesn't work.
It might.
It works for commercial.
And that's what the example. You weren't at the meeting, but the finance committee, Mr. Burton asked folks who had both successes and failures with community development authorities to come to
county
finance committee. And we were lucky, it was a really short notice, but Henrico County came and Stafford County came. And Henrico has had a series of successes, and they talked about what the key to their successes in their mind was. It had been commercial, they had been for limited time periods, and they had done it the same way to some extent that we did with this thing from the one you're on, which has really been kind of a partnership from the very beginning. So yeah, you knew you were involved.
I'm familiar with Henrico because I've been down there and seen that huge retail complex.
Short pump, right, where it's already paid off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they have a policy of no, they will not issue a CDA that has a residential complex.
Right.
Well, the other thing has been is the owner's ability to pay.
Yeah, Lerner has big pocket.
Yeah, because they generally own and are paying most of the bonds for the first several years.
Especially
in this environment, and so you have to look at that.
In my view, this is a partnership. And that is the kind of thing that you want to know who's the partner on the other side of the table. Is it just some nameless LLC or is it some real? And again, I think with the learners, a lot of it had to be learners.
They weren't bringing in enough to cover the payments in the early years.
Oh no, they were. Lerner paid it. They owned most of the land that was CDA, and they paid the freight.
Just paid it, right?
And they didn't make that.
The other example that was used was Stafford County.
And
Stafford County has the Celebrate Virginia, has their portion of Celebrate Virginia, which is, I wouldn't necessarily say a disaster, but a challenge would be the right way. Right? And it's Carl Silver's property down there.
Right.
Now, certainly he's got the deep pockets, but it wasn't set up in such a way that he's certainly not taking moral responsibility for that particular project. And then in the midst of all of it, the Stafford, for reasons that we can't understand, allowed some of the commercial property to be rezoned to a senior housing project.
Well, if the original developer just has a philosophy of selling off the ground to other investors, then you can run into difficulties because you don't know what their wherewithal is. I mean, Lerner doesn't sell anything. I mean, they sold their property to the Cooperative Finance Corporation for their headquarters, but that's the only thing they've sold out there. They keep everything. That's their whole business model.
So as part of our due diligence, that's part of what we're doing, is trying to make sure that we understand and are able to tell the board who's on the other side of the table.
How big is the Concord CDA?
Well, the original proposal has changed many times. There are two sets of things that have to be financed. One is Pacific Boulevard and the Russell Branch extension. And that's probably about $35 million. Then there's Gloucester, which is probably $40 million. And, it's not long, but it's in essence a causeway. So you know what it's going to cost to build a big causeway, right? So they're trying to get a loan from the state for the Gloucester part. and they would back the loan for the state, what they're offering, to pay off the loan for the state is an enhanced proffer amount of about $35,000 per housing unit. And they're looking at a 10-year build-out, and that would be enough to pay off all of that debt.
And how's that going to affect the affordable housing portion of that?
They're excluded from that.
Oh, they are?
Yes.
Oh, that's...
Yes, they are. Because I keep saying you should add it to those, but they say no. So what they were originally proposing was that the non-residential parts of the development would therefore pay for the... You could do a special assessment that would pay for the Pacific and Russell Branch. And a little bit of Pacific would be done with the Gloucester part, actually, because that makes more sense from a project point of view. That probably would have been, like I said, $30, $35 million. That would not be uncomparable to what happened right across the street with the Dulles Town Center.
36.8.
Right. So it's not, it's a big number, but it's not a terrible number. But they've been working with the state. They have determined that they need a governmental entity to actually be the one responsible for this, because if it's a governmental entity applying to the Virginia Transportation Infrastructure Bank, there is actually the ability to get a grant or a supplement from the state for part of the project. So what they'd like to be able to do is to issue this debt over 10 years to this, loan to the state over 10 years, but pay no interest over that 10-year time period. So what they're asking to do, though, is to still do the enhanced proffer, but have it backstopped by the CDA.
You also have to remember, though, that Lerner paid $7 million towards the interchange on Route 7, right, in addition to the $37 million in road improvements through the CDA.
Right.
And then the Commonwealth Transportation Board contributed about $3 million to finish the northeast quadrant of that interchange.
Did they come to the county for this financing, or is it just because it's transportation?
Private.
No, it is a topic that we will deal with again.
The board has a policy for reviewing community development authorities. They have asked staff to begin that process, and we're going through our checklist. Both our financial advisors and a commercial consultant are going to help us take a look at the business plans that are implicit in all of this, because we have to worry about it. It's the stadium, it's the residential sections, including the affordable housing, and then it's the commercial. And how does that work? How do all of these different pieces work? How likely is this scenario? What happens if, 10 years down the line?
The key issue is going to be the county's obligation if things go south.
Right.
That will be the key issue. There's a lot of maneuvering going on with that.
Well, Lerner didn't involve... Lerner went to the private capital markets in New York to finance the CDA. And so there are bondholders that are being paid back over 30 years for that $37 million.
The county...
There's different ways to do it.
The county created the Community Development Authority, and the county approved the sale of the CDA bonds for the Dulles Town Center, because they're able to get tax exempt rate at that point. And rather than having to do the construction financing, as you're generally limited to, 3 to 5 years, they're able to go
30 years.
Right. But it was, but I can tell you, I have friends who people I used to work with, who bought those bonds. And when they were doing the credit analysis, they were looking at not just the county's fiscal impact statement, not just what was in the official statement with regard to what the business plan was. They were also looking at what was behind this. And the selling point, as you said, really was the fact that it was the learners behind it.
Just back to this report. So you said that it's likely that the rail project, Loudoun's part of it, is going to be somewhere between $260 and $280 million?
Yep.
And this shows that, is this showing that you're going to...
That's capital costs.
Huh?
Right, capital costs. Mm-hmm.
And this shows you're going to bring in an additional $290 million?
Right.
So it about breaks even?
So over the 30-year period, the present value is about the same. And we didn't add any inflation to this at all. So the present value is about the same. But when you're doing rail, it's not a 20 or 30-year investment.
Yeah.
If you're attaching your community to a to a rail system, that's a 50 to 100 year commitment. I mean, you know, the London Underground still runs all the places it used to. The New York subway system does, and you know, those costs to build it, you know, 100 years ago are meaningless to, you know, to the people of today. So it's one of those cases where you're really taken.
You got to take
really
the long
back and take a long, long look.
And the way the schedule is laying out now, they will have the final cost numbers.
After the new year.
After the new year, it may not be till March, in that time frame. And then the board of supervisors has 90 days in which to decide whether to opt out or stay in.
I believe that, you know, there's a strong drive to have a memorandum of understanding between all the funding partners and the federal government on this put together in the next couple of weeks. And they may be getting close to that. So, you know, a lot of the details have been worked out. A lot of the governance problems have been worked out. A lot of the issues that you've seen in the newspaper have been worked out. So,
good.
Things are going well.
Well, we'll see.
So, as you know, this is a big document. I think, you know.
Oh, it's a good.
I
document.
Think you're going to find this stuff very interesting. Yeah. I know the print's really tiny, but this is available online to look at, and the PDF files are a lot easier to read online.
So, Ben, if we build a garage at the station, we'll be able to charge whatever the Greenway guys are paying for toll.
For the garage?
Yeah, for parking.
No. Well, with the parking garages, with the parking garages, yeah, what we're looking at is, yes, I mean, yeah, that would be one of the competitive factors, is what's it going to cost you to go those 3 miles on the Greenway? And, you know, and again, when you look at the long-range tolls, Mr. Burton, you know, that the issue of the Fairfax part of the toll road having, you know, $10 tolls, in and of itself, it depends on what year is that $10. Because $10 30 years from now, you know, what is that really? You know, maybe $4 today.
A cup of coffee.
The concern we're watching with all of this is how fast does it ramp up to those numbers.
Starbucks
up too
more
fast,
than
it's going to drive people off the toll road.
Right. Well, the first analysis we saw showed that they would, you know, under their original plan, when it was the underground station and you know, $3.8 billion of project compared to 2.5 as originally proposed, that they might well force a third of the riders
off the toll road.
Off the toll road. And you know, I just can't imagine what would happen in Fairfax at that point, because there's just not enough parallel roads
anymore. I just don't know. I'm trying to keep an open mind, and I don't know how I'm going to vote.
It's going to be way better than it was. Improvements have been made.
And real quick, before we, our next step is to wait for direction from the board.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's where we're going to see if you still exist.
Right. Well, not that.
And
but
that's
just
what we're going to do in the spring.
Yeah. But again, if you're interested, you know, in applying to be members again next year.
Oh, we're going to send that letter. Everyone.
Yeah, didn't we decide to do the joint letter?
We're going to do. And we'll send. I want to send a letter to the board saying something.
I got to say, my personal perspective, this has been a good group to work with.
You guys are a pretty good group.
Yeah, right.
Y'all ask good hard questions without getting in fistfights, and that's, you know, in and of itself.
Well, there's been years when we had some dissension,
yes.
and there have been years. Papers
yes.
written.
Yes.
Yes.
That must be before your time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
There have been some ugly moments here. Yeah.
Thank you, young lady.
So, thank you very much.
I never thought I'd hear the word Proctor 200 times a day.
Yeah.
Proctor.
Yeah.
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 Proctor.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes.
I never understood that.
Is that all?
That's it. Thank you.
Yeah. There were some.